Well, good morning. I'm Vince Witkowski. I chair the Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group, which is sponsoring this event, co-sponsored with the George Mason University Scalia Law School National Security Institute. I want to thank you all for taking time from your busy days and busy lives to be with us. We've worked hard to make it worth your time. I want to thank some of the folks who were particularly involved in organizing this at the Federalist Society, Laura Flint, at the Institute, Jessica Jones, and then the two chairs of the two panels. I'll try to do a brief intro of each. It's hard to do a brief one of Jamil because he's a young man with a long history of public service. He's the founder of the Mason National Security Institute, director of the National Security Law and Policy Program, and an adjunct professor at Scalia. He, as a younger man, clerked for Judge Edith Jones in the Fifth Circuit and Judge Gorsuch in the Tenth Circuit. In the Bush administration, he served in the Justice Department and the Office of Legal Policy and the National Security Division. He then served as an associate White House counsel on national security affairs. In the Obama years, he was senior counsel to the House Intelligence Committee and then chief counsel and senior advisor to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He's affiliated with various think tanks and organizations, and he's in the corporate world. He's VP for Strategy and Business Development at IronNet Cybersecurity, which is a tech firm founded by former NSA Director Keith Alexander and also Matthew Allen. The next panel will be chaired by Matthew Hyman. Matthew is a visiting fellow at the National Security Institute at George Mason. He's chair of the Cyber and Privacy Working Group of the Federalist Society. He's an active member of the Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group, and will be the incoming chair of the group within a day or two. In the past, he's been a legal advisor to the Iraq Coalition Provisional Authority, and then an attorney in the National Security Division at Justice. He's held various positions of legal positions at Tyco and Johnson Controls. Before I sit down for the day, I'd encourage any of you who are interested in these issues or the Federal Society or public policy in general who would like to be involved with the Society to approach me or Matthew. Give us your card, Jamil, as well, and we can start a conversation on that. So with that, Jamil.
Well, Vince, thanks for having me, and thanks for having us, and thanks to the Federal Society for hosting this event with the National Security Institute at George Mason University. I'm excited to host this panel and to tell you a little bit about our panelists and what this panel is about. So today, this first panel, we'll be talking about the role of the tech titans, the big technology companies in cybersecurity, how they think about cybersecurity, how they think about it with respect to their customers, their partners, their clients, and the like. And how they think about it in terms of working with one another or with the government to address the cybersecurity concerns of their clients. The next panel will talk more about the relationship between government and the tech companies. And then we'll hear from Ken Weinstein, the former head of the National Security Division at the Justice Department and the former assistant to the president for counterterrorism and homeland security. So with that, let me introduce the panel. Immediately to my left is Andrea Limbago. Dr. Andrea Limbago is the chief social scientist at Endgame, where she researches and writes on geopolitics and cybersecurity issues. She's written in a variety of publications, including Politico, The Hill, Business Insider, War on the Rocks, and Forbes. She looks at things like attacker techniques and trends, computational propaganda, and the like. She previously worked in academia and at the Department of Defense. She holds a PhD in political science from the University of Colorado at Boulder, where Justice Gorsuch used to teach, where she taught international relations and foreign policy courses, and a bachelor's degree from Bowdoin College. Is that the right pronunciation?
Bowdoin.
I should know that.
That's right.
There you go. We have some alumni in the audience. Immediately to her left is Angela McKay. Angela is the Senior Director of Cybersecurity Policy and Strategy at Microsoft, where she leads Microsoft's public policy work on cybersecurity, cloud security, norms, and public sector use of the cloud. She serves on the Board of Counselors of the East-West Institute, as the key point of contact for Microsoft at the NSTAC, the National Security Telecommunications Advisory Committee. And she previously led Microsoft's cybersecurity policy work across the U.S., worked at Booz Allen Hamilton and at Bell South Telecommunications as an engineer. She holds a bachelor's degree in industrial systems engineering from Georgia Tech. Go Jackets. And then finally, at the end of our panel, but certainly not least, David Lieber, who's a senior privacy policy counsel for Google based in the Washington, D.C. office. In that capacity, David works on cybersecurity policy, government access, and international privacy issues. Prior to joining Google, David worked on e-commerce and privacy issues at DLA Piper. And previously served in the Senate, working for Senator Dick Durbin on the Senate Judiciary Committee. He's a graduate of Bates College, also another alumni, my old boss, Bob Goodlatte, also Bates College alumni, and the Northwestern University School of Law, the rival of my law school, the University of Chicago. So have fun downtown. We were having fun down on the south side. So with that, a distinguished panel, and I'm very excited to have the group. What I thought I'd do is start at the end with David. And David, if you could tell us sort of the way that Google thinks about cybersecurity, the way it thinks about cybersecurity in relation to its clients, its customers, and whether you think how Google thinks about working with other industry partners and the government when it comes to delivering cybersecurity to its clients and customers.
Yeah. So thank you, Jamil. Thank you to the National Security Institute, at George Mason, Federal Society, Jones Day. I think I got everyone out of the way here. So we are. We're facing a number of unique cybersecurity challenges, and part of the reason that is the case is because we have 7 products now with over 1 billion users. And securing the infrastructure that provides those products and services is mission critical for Google. But operationalizing risk management across those products and services is complicated because each of those products and services have unique unique sort of threat models, attack surfaces, et cetera. And so the task of doing that is complicated in terms of identifying and detecting potential risks, protecting our users, our customers, and infrastructure in light of those risks, and preventing and mitigating harm in the event that we see vulnerabilities out there or we perceive that there are vulnerabilities that we need to address and patch. We are always operating under the assumption that our users expect us to deliver security out of the box. That's a reasonable expectation for our users to have. But in light of increasing attack vectors, if you think about the proliferation of internet-connected devices, or even the growth of sophisticated spear phishing attacks targeted at specific users, security is increasingly a shared responsibility. And so it's incumbent upon companies like Google to develop security tools that users can avail themselves of when they want to improve their cybersecurity posture. That is sometimes in tension with the notion that security should work for people. People shouldn't have to work for security. Usable security across our industry is something I think we're increasingly focused on. As I mentioned, you know, people expect us to deliver security out of the box. When they're using one of our products or services, at least the baseline assumption is that they don't have to do anything. Increasingly, though, as people, you know, bad actors seek to evade our perimeter defenses, they're focusing on our users. And so we're trying to provide tools that users can use to better protect themselves against those threats. And so we want security to be, you know, easy to use, intuitive, and where feasible, provided by default. And so we're trying to sort of rise to the challenge in light of the threats that we see. You know, you talked a little bit about, you know, governments. We work with, you know, governments in information sharing where appropriate. You know, this is a complicated subject because to the extent that people perceive that we are sharing information with governments and in service of those governments or at the behest of them, that can diminish trust, and trust is the lifeblood of internet activity. But we work with partners, you know, including the U.S. government, because we have shared goals and objectives. Last year, the Department of Justice, you know, commended us for our work in helping to identify and apprehend the perpetrator of the security breach that affected, you know, 500 million Yahoo users. So we have shared goals and objectives in ensuring the broader security of the ecosystem. And we do, we have a threat analysis group that works with various government entities when we see threats that are out there to ensure the broader integrity of the ecosystem.
Great. So, Angela, you all have a slightly different scenario where you're delivering a tremendous number of products to consumers, to businesses, in a different sort of different way, perhaps, than Google does. How do you guys think about cybersecurity for your users? How do you think about working with companies and partners like big players like Google or other players in the industry? Sort of what's Microsoft's sense of this? And we know that Microsoft has said some things about working with the government recently. Tell us more about that, if you could.
Yes. So thank you, Jamil. Thank you to the Federalist Society, the National Security Institute, and Jones Day. I think I hit everyone. But it's a real pleasure to be here. I definitely want to hit on what Jamil has asked me about around kind of how we work with others. But I thought for one second I would just zoom out and talk for a moment about how we see the scale and nature of the challenges in cyberspace right now. One of the things I think that is really interesting and Andrea and I were actually talking about this beforehand, is like, y'all are all in the room because you seem to already care about this issue. But, you know, as I engage outside of this room and outside of many conversations, there's a lot of people who don't understand or appreciate cybersecurity challenges. They read it in the newspaper and they see headlines, but they don't necessarily understand the individual impact. A couple of things I think are really interesting. I looked up this number as I was on my way in. In 2018, you had 4 billion internet users on a global basis. And almost 25% of those users were coming online for the first time in 2017. Think about that, right? Almost 1 billion new users last year. And as David basically mentioned, not necessarily all these users or all the new companies who are entrants in this space are taking into account the lessons learned from IT to IoT, for example. So you basically have this large user set on a global basis. You're going to have the users have lots of different devices in the north. I like to call it a device-rich global north and a user-rich global south. That is where the largest number of users coming online is growing. And you don't necessarily have the lessons learned from different environments, and they also have different norms or societal expectations around the role of government, the role of industry. And so when we start to think about the subject of how do you work with others, you have to think about this as a global problem that we're working on, and that not everyone approaches the problem set from the same vantage point of risk or from the same expectations about the role of government and the role of industry in addressing the challenges. Maybe one other thing before I move into how we work with others is, I think it's really important, when I was reading, I always read the session description before I go up to speak somewhere, always feels good to know what we're supposed to be talking about. But I was looking at this and it said something about the, you know, how we respond or deal with the attacks like WannaCry, which had 200,000 computers affected in over 150 countries. You know, behind each one of those computers and in all these countries, something I think that we can do collectively to help people address cybersecurity is connect that to individuals, the economic impact, and the societal impact. And so I'd just like to highlight in thinking about that is with WannaCry, you know, you had over 19,000 appointments canceled at the UK's National Health Service. Think about if you were one of those people who was going in to find out what the results of your cancer test had been. How would you feel if that appointment was randomly canceled? That is a set of individuals and a societal function, the public health system, that were taken offline. And with the NotPetya attacks, you had over $850 million of impact from a single attack. But people tend to think about it as the number of computers that were affected in Ukraine. So when we roll in all of that thinking about the challenges, it's a global landscape that we have to be working with others in, and we have to appreciate how we deal in that environment. So do we think that individual action is important? Of course. We have all kinds of things in our products and services to help protect, detect, and respond to events. One of my favorites that I really like, actually, is the Advanced Threat Protection in Cloud. What that does is if it detects a known malware signature, scans the entire cloud environment and can, at scale and in real time, help protect users in that way. That's something that we do individually. When I think about the industry-to-industry work, and I hope you ask questions about this more on so I don't spend all my 3 minutes, is we have made a commitment to something called the Tech Accord. Over 44 companies based in different places around the world making a commitment to a series of principles around improving defenses, not doing offense, helping each other, and helping others in this space. And so we think that that's really, really important. Something that I encourage the group to think about, and maybe we'll get some questions about this, is the word collective. I looked it up again on my way in. There are different definitions, and I think this frames some of the differences in how people think about collective defense. There's a definition of collective that is a group acting as one, which would imagine or assume that you necessarily had the exact same purposes or objectives. There's another definition that talks about an aggregate impact. And I think that's one that, at least from our perspective, is one to frame into the discussion of collective defenses. We may not all be acting with the same capabilities and the same objectives, but they are oftentimes complementary. Sometimes they are the same and can have a significant aggregate effect in the ecosystem.
Great. Well, thanks, Angela. Andrew, you, Endgame provides services to some of the tech titans, to other companies, and to sometimes individuals.
No, it's a product company.
Typically, you provide a defensive product.
Yeah.
Do you provide it to individuals and to corporations
or primarily corporations?
Primarily corporations. So in that role, how do you all think about the cybersecurity ecosystem? Tell us about how you guys see the threat and how you see what you've heard from David and Angela, how that plays into Endgame in your view as a social scientist of these issues and how you see us going forward.
All right, and extend my thanks as well for everyone to be here. I'm excited to be on such a great panel. It should be an exciting conversation. And just building upon a lot of what they have said, because I agree with a lot of it. From a vendor perspective, obviously for us, our key mission is to protect the world's data. I mean, I think any credible security vendor will tell you something along those lines. So that's not terribly unique, but it's really important, and it's really mission-driven. And the threat landscape really is evolving a lot. And I was just talking to some folks yesterday, and yesterday was the one-year anniversary of NotPetya. So we all talk about WannaCry, but NotPetya actually was the one that really, from my perspective, and I think a lot of folks that look at the attacker trends, was more of the game changer in that, had a destructive element to it. The notion that collateral damage really no longer matters. You had targets in the Ukraine, and then it spread, costing, by some estimates, over $1 billion worth of damage across the globe, hundreds of millions of dollars to a couple of major corporations who are still trying to respond to it. And so it highlights sort of the evolving nature of the threat landscape, and that's really what we're seeing. You've got the proliferation of the open source capabilities and exploits, like from Shadow Brokers and Vol7. That's now helped democratize some of those capabilities to other actors, which you saw WannaCry, NotPetya, Bad Rabbit, all had Eternal Blue or Eternal Romance exploits in them that came from those breaches. And so we're seeing that proliferation. We see proliferation of actors. Vietnam has an APT now linked to it. And so you're starting to see some of the smaller countries are copycatting what the major countries are doing. And so that, again, when you look at any kind of military innovation or technology innovation, it diffuses down. And so we're seeing more and more actors having some of those capabilities as well. And so that spreads. And then you also have the sort of the attack surface spreading as far as IoT, but also the absence of really anything being off limits right now. And so that's sort of the extension of how everything is just proliferating and becoming more and more complex. And so while that's all going on, in the U.S., as the private sector is really the owners and operators of the data and the infrastructure for a lot of these targets that are getting attacked, it's really entering a new kind of, it's a new landscape that the government and the private sector have to look at and figure out new ways to work together. And other countries are moving ahead in that. And so it's not just that that policy lags behind technology. in other countries, especially authoritarian ones, it's a much closer gap. You know, they're seeing technology innovate and they're evolving their policies a lot faster. And if you think about like China's 2025 as far as indigenous innovation, but then even they have something called China 2035, which Elsa Kanye wrote a really good paper about, I'd recommend reading, where you know, the government's working with their major tech giants to form the standards for next gen. And so looking at 5G and other areas for way, you know, for the evolution of the internet. And so they're working hand in hand with their tech giants to help shape it in their own interest. And I think we need to find some way to have our private sector and our government work together in a way that still maintains privacy and protection and innovation while also helping protect our national and economic security. And I think that's where we need to see a lot more innovation. I think we do really well in tech innovation. We don't do so well in policy innovation and collaboration and innovation in that area. So that would be something I'd love to see you pushing forward. But obviously, it's challenging. That's where actually it's more of the social science challenge is actually getting the businesses and the government to work together versus I think the tech we can overcome. Some of the social issues are going to be harder.
Thanks, Andrea. So Angela, on that point, Andrea made the point that the threat is democratizing, right? So we have these advanced government capabilities now out there in the open space, now being utilized by potentially other governments, but also, hacker groups and the like, criminal groups. And we've seen some of that already happen. And one of the solutions I think that Andrea posits is that we've got to get government and industry closer together, working on the defensive side. And you mentioned briefly in your opening remarks about the Tech Accord, how Microsoft has quarterbacked an effort with companies to get collaboration on defense, but also to sort of say no to the government and to agree to say no to governments on offense. Tell us more about how Microsoft thinks about sort of the difference between offense and defense, why one, not the other, and how that either empowers or limits. I'm going to guess you're not going to say limits the ability to work with the governments on these issues.
So I think the things that are really important is maybe just starting with a full, like, we don't engage in offense. Very simply, it's just not the side of work that we engage in. However, you can do a lot on the defensive side, and I think that one of the things we really think about is in engaging with governments, governments are our customers, right? They are large buyers and users of IT. Governments are protectors of national security and public safety. And in that context, there's a lot of work to be done collaborating in the technical domain, in the operational domain, in the policy domain to help improve defenses. And at the same time, governments are also exploiters of technology to help realize some of their goals. And so in that, you just have to be very thoughtful about how you're engaging, when you're engaging, and what you're engaging on. One of the things that we have posited out in the ecosystem is this idea that we need to have better rules of the road for understanding those things that are acceptable or unacceptable behaviors of both states and of companies in cyberspace. It is underneath the title of the Digital Geneva Convention, and what we are basically saying is, in this environment where there are escalating threats, primarily from nation states, but we're also very concerned about the bleed over into non-nation state environments that with actors who do not operate with the same limits of behavior, that there need to be greater rules of the road for what is acceptable and unacceptable behavior. And then, importantly, when there is a violation of an agreed upon rule, some type of consequence for it. That's how we ultimately, I believe, will help and deter some of the actors from engaging in particularly malicious or particularly deleterious effects like disrupting computer networks, turning off an entire machine, making it into a box. Like, you just have to ultimately deter some behavior.
So say more about the consequences. So you've talked about setting out rules of the road and these companies collaborating on sort of a digital genomic convention, sort of a private sector version of what have typically been government agreements, or maybe there's a government piece to it. That'd be great to hear more about that.
Okay.
And then tell us about how you see those being effectuated with consequences. Do you imagine working with the government to effectuate consequences, or is it something that the industry would do itself? Would you cut people off? Would you limit their access? Right. I mean, I'm not trying to get into that, which I know is a dangerous area of some discussion that people have had with the FCC and the like. But what's the sort of thinking there? And then I'd love to hear David's thoughts on these too.
Yeah, so a couple of things. Underneath the concept of the Digital Geneva Convention, there are a couple of different lenses. One is that we believe that there is a need for the international law applies in cyberspace, but that there are challenges or gaps in understanding how it applies, and that there may be some gaps in law that need to be filled. So there is a piece advancing a legal agreement among governments that helps to address some of those either lack of clarity or potential gaps in the ecosystem. So there's a government lens. Then there is the tech accord that says, you know what, this is not just government's responsibility alone. Industry can work individually and collectively to help improve security and stability. That's where this set of 44 companies have made a series of commitments around what we will do to help advance security and stability, and what we won't do. Think about that as sometimes industry can move a little bit more agilely in this space. And then the last piece is thinking about how industry and government, either individually or collectively, can help drive accountability. In that space, we do not believe that industry is the one who would be driving forward sanctions or consequences, that is a governmental role. But we can actually help in this environment, whether it is things like Microsoft and Facebook doing attribution and a takedown of the Zinc malware, right, which is us helping the environment, or contributing information that would help with attribution of attacks.
Got it. So David, Angela talked about the global landscape that we're seeing with threats. It's a global problem, and that there's a role for both government and industry, but there's an appropriate role. And you talked about that a little bit too. You talked about the billions of customers that Google has, the unique threat model that we face. How do you see what you just heard from Angela in terms of this idea that there's a role for government, which is delivering the consequences, but there's a role for industry in helping deliver those when appropriate under the law, but also for industry separately, working together to establish rules of the road. Does Google see it the same way? Does Google see it differently? What's your sort of thinking about that?
I think we definitely have shared objectives here and goals in protecting the broader ecosystem. One of the challenges I think we see in the international realm in particular, this is less a problem with the U.S. government. It's not a problem with the U.S. government. It's a challenge with other governments. It's even at a threshold level. The definitional contours around this concept of cybersecurity. We view cybersecurity, we probably could forge some consensus around the tables in this room about what that means, protecting users from unauthorized access or acquisition to user data, protecting systems from unauthorized intrusions. When we have conversations with other governments, they're more fraught and tense around some of these subject around the subject matter because they view cybersecurity in a much different vein. They view it in terms of content moderation, government surveillance, data localization, and even efforts to stifle free expression and dissent. And so even at that sort of foundational level, sometimes it's challenging to have these conversations with governments who fundamentally just, you know, have different definitions of the term. That doesn't preclude us from working with like-minded governments, with companies to identify the threats that we see, to make sure that we're sharing intelligence about those threats so that other companies are aware of them to the extent that actors are going to be acting, you know, in similar ways across different services and attempting to, you know, commandeer accounts in similar ways. So I think it's just a question of how do you effectuate this broader goal? And I think we're working with other companies. We work with Microsoft, Facebook, you know, many other companies. We tend to do it through less formal relationships, but I think we all, at the end of the day, have the same objectives.
So Andrea, you've heard about sort of formal relationships, informal relationships, the idea of creating rules for the road through industry, working with governments, though, to address gaps in the law. One of the things that we've talked about, that people have talked about in the cybersecurity realm, is this idea of creating collective defense. Right, the idea that we're stronger working together, and as Angela correctly laid out, there's different ways to think about collective. Is it we all are doing the same thing and doing it for the same reasons, or is it aggregate? Are we all doing it for different purposes, maybe in slightly different ways, but the goal is a larger, more secure ecosystem? How do you and how does Endgame think about collective defense? And how that gets delivered, and is it about people who have to work together because they have the same vision, or can people have different visions or different goals and still collaborate, as Angela described, and get to a more secure goal at the end of the day?
Yeah, but I think it's going to be layered. I think in some regards, you know, different corporations are going to have different objectives as far as, you know, they've got their own ROI and those kind of things to deal with. But at a higher level, they can still have, you know, economic and national security and just the overall protection of data as overarching objectives that kind of that unite them. And that's how, you know, you think about collective security and collective defense, you know, for me as an international relations background, you think about NATO, right? And that's one of the, you know, the stronger and most successful alliances that we've seen. And it's based on collective security, where an attack on one is an attack on all. Article 5 has included cyber attacks now. Is it a cyber attack on one, is an attack on all. And the assumption is that other groups will come in and support. That also has definitional challenges, like you were talking about. And I think that is such a great point, because I think we fail to see how the attackers, especially from many of the authoritarian nation states, do view cybersecurity in such a broad way. It's, you know, it's information control for them. And if we're not looking at it from that perspective, we're not defending against the right thing. And so we really need to think about it. We don't have to adopt that framework, but we have to understand that framework so we can have better defenses against that broad range of you know, malicious activity that can occur online. And so, you know, getting back to the question, as far as, you know, corporations absolutely can work together while still pursuing their own, satisfying their corporate boards and those kind of things, because also, you know, it's in their best interest to protect their data, right? I mean, you've got the IP, you've got the PII, you know, a whole range of interests there that, you know, is going to help them, you know, meet their fiduciary requirements and their, you know, all those kind of things, in addition to actually helping the other corporations, because you do see an awful lot where, you know, industries themselves have similar attack trends. And so, you know, like oil and gas has certain kinds of attacks and vectors and targets. Same with financial, and that's why they have the ISACs, information sharing groups. And those, I think, are helpful as far as starting to get to that point where you get some more of the collective security and collective defense. And so there are already some foundational elements moving in that direction, which I think are great. And I think we just still need to be able to continue that. And, you know, the government's helping out by providing some standards for information sharing. But a lot of these are still just baby steps and not, you know, they're still trying to tackle yesterday's, you know, threat landscape versus getting us ready for tomorrow's, which is just, it's evolving so fast.
Well, so that's interesting. So you talked a little bit about sort of NATO and this idea of sort of collective defense in the construct where an attack on one is an attack on all. Angela, can you see industry collaborating so closely that you might take the position that attack on one major industry player, one of the quote-unquote tech titans, is attack on all, and you can see the other tech titans coming to your collective defense? Is that a scenario, either under the tech accord or under agreements that come later on out of the tech accord, as being a realistic scenario, or is that sort of a bridge too far?
First of all, I'll qualify. We were in scenario planning here. but what I would say is, you know, knowing the level of collaboration on security that occurs in not just the tech industry, but among the particularly high capability actor space, which is not just in the tech industry. The financial service is a classic example. There is a large degree of collaboration, and I think that if there is a particular organization or subsector who was under significant attack, you do find that organizations basically say, I have some capability to bring to bear here, right? There is a degree of and a recognition that the trust that individual organizations and the trust in the technology industry is something that is important beyond any individual organization. And that's where you start to get to collaboration among competitors to realize that we need to ensure this trust in the technology and of the infrastructure and the space. Because otherwise, we all will have an existential crisis, not just the companies, but we'll start to challenge the huge benefits that digital transformation is bringing to society, right? You would not just have individual productivity losses, you would start to actually have people not realize the economic and societal benefits of technology.
So this is an interesting point. So David, you're a lawyer, and there's a lot of lawyers in this room, and oftentimes we hear that the lawyers get in the way of the kind of sharing that Angela just described, right? So I think it's interesting, we have a panel of a doctor, an engineer, and a lawyer. It's like a beginning of a good joke. But I do wonder whether and how you as a lawyer at Google and how Google, and I didn't realize you're not necessarily in a lawyer role all the time because you do a lot of policy stuff, putting your lawyer hat on, how do you see lawyers as either making it harder or more cautious or absorbing risk when it comes to this question of acting together? Because a lot of times at least in the financial services sector, which Angela talked about, we see the FSISAC and FSARC as having said, we're getting the lawyers out of the room. The threat is just so substantial that we need to do this regardless of what the lawyers tell us. Even though there may be consequences, we need to get this because the systemic consequences are so dramatic. How does Google think about that question?
Yeah, it's a great question. I do think, to our government's credit and the credit of the U.S. Congress, that they've been considering these issues in recent years. And even prior to the passage of CISA in 2015, under existing law, under the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, I think a lot of companies felt comfortable with their capacity to engage in information sharing without implicating the strictures of the prohibitions under ECPA. But then CISA certainly, reinforced that principle to the extent that there was skepticism about the ability to voluntarily share information and do so in a way that wouldn't incur additional risk or exposure. Congress certainly made that clear. There also have been ongoing questions in the antitrust space about the ability of companies to share information in a way that doesn't violate the antitrust laws. And in 2014, the FTC and the Department of Justice issued a joint policy statement, basically largely saying that antitrust law shouldn't be a barrier to legitimate sharing of information for cybersecurity purposes, and that was again reinforced too in CISA. So I think there have been a lot of there's been directionally like positive movement in terms of reducing legal barriers for this type of information sharing. Where it gets more complicated, and I think we are in agreement with Angela here too about undertaking offensive measures. The legal landscape for that is far from clear, and arguably statutes like the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act prohibit that type of activity. But there are also really important policy reasons why we should be skeptical about going down that road, authorizing private entities to be engaging in activity that's traditionally been reserved for governments, and that governments are much better positioned to be making these decisions. I think Angela was alluding to the both attribution and accountability, and governments are best positioned to be able to make decisions about what type of responses are proportionate. Does a cyber attack necessitate a cyber response or a response in some other way? Through economic sanctions, companies may misattribute attack. They may think that they're dealing with an actor that's less sophisticated than they are, then they turn out to be a nation state that doesn't care about the consequences of its actions. So in that particular area, I think that one is fraught, and it's there are good reasons, I think, why we haven't seen that explicit authorization for, I think, what's referred to as hackback authority.
So on that same note, I do want to leave some time for questions from the audience, so we'll turn to that in just a second. But on that issue of hackback, right, if we put a hackback to one side and we talk about work with the government on things other than a hackback, so you think about, Google had a recent situation with Project Maven where they decided to back out of or decided no longer to work with the government on artificial intelligence. Are the challenges that led to Google's decision in Project Maven likely to make it harder for Google, putting aside offensive, to work with the government defensively in this space? Or because AI seems like it's not really offense necessarily, although maybe there's some overlap there that we're not sure about. How do you think about that? How did you all, as you saw the reaction from your workforce and decided to think about how to take decisions based on what you heard from the workforce, how does that influence your thinking about further collaboration with the governments, assuming they're governments you can work with going forward?
Yeah, so I think those issues around Project Maven are separate and distinct, I think, from the issues that we're talking about today and our work with governments in order to reduce the likelihood of cyber threats across the ecosystem. So I don't think that's going to affect our...
So they can be segregated from...
Yeah, and I think it's just a different universe of government actors as well, the intelligence community versus, I think, those who have authority over cybersecurity and law enforcement. We haven't
There's broader tension, as I mentioned before, around information sharing and how that may affect the broader sort of trust quotient,
right.
But vis-a-vis our interactions with governments to reduce cyber threats, I don't see any additional tension.
So you know, Angela, David had talked about how trust is the lifeblood of sort of, you know, companies work with their consumers and their clients on the internet. And you obviously watched what happened with Maven, and David says to us it's sort of segregable. And of course, Microsoft has sort of said, we're not going to work with the government on offense. We're leading this group of technology companies on offense. Does that affect at all in your mind the ability to work on defense? Or are those issues also segregable such that you can collaborate on defense, which you made clear, I think, that the companies that are in the tech world want to do that. So I think my sense is that you do think they're segregable, but do you see them the same way that David and Google does?
Turned off the button. We definitely see them as segregable, to use your language. And I think that there are spaces where what is active defense to one may be offense to another,
right?
And so I think one of the things that becomes really, really important is having clarity, principles, and consistency in how you engage. it becomes a way to continue guiding and being very equal. I think one of the other things I was trying to highlight earlier, and David, I loved the definitional challenge, is, you know, we may say we only collaborate or we only coordinate and work together on cyber defense, but then some governments think that has a different frame than others.
Like shut down activists.
Yeah, right. And so that's where you have to have your corporate principles about how you effectuate that commitment. And that becomes really important in terms of consistency and parity in your work around the world.
Well, so Andrea, I can see you want to weigh in on this because corporate principles, right? That this is sort of what the kind of work you do and you think about as a social scientist. Tell us a little bit, and then I'll turn to the audience for questions, a little bit about how sort of from your perch as a social scientist at a security-focused company, how you all and how you personally think about what you've heard from David and Angela about the ability to segregate. Can you really segregate between offense and defense? Can you segregate between, on one hand, work with the intelligence community on artificial intelligence and work with the government on defensive measures? And if you can, how do corporate principles and ethos and human behavior play into all that?
Yeah, so it's hard.
It's hard.
So I think anyone tells you otherwise is lying to you. So it's interesting. The role of offense over the last month has really dominated a lot of headlines. I think the Pentagon's been talking about it quite a bit with Cybercom and so forth, with authorities. Whether the pendulum now is swinging all the way to focus on offense on the government side. And I think just because we're hearing about it a bit more, I think, and on the one hand, it's also catching up a bit, and more so is in line with some aspects of reality, whereas before you're mainly just talking about defense. But it's not saying that defense isn't as important now, especially in the DOD and for the IC and the government at large. DHS has their whole strategy focused on defense. And so, it is more of a continuum. A lot of the offense that you learn can then inform defense, and that's how a lot of our roots at Endgame are that way. We have a lot of people with backgrounds in the government on offense, leveraging those skill sets, so for defense and understanding how the attackers are going to work and using that knowledge to block. But then you have aspects like AI. I mean, AI is going to be tough because it's dual use at the end of the day. We're leading a panel at DEF CON this year on AI Village, where there's going to be some aspects on adversarial machine learning, and so you have attackers leveraging machine learning models to attack other machine learning models. And that's not too far off in the future. And so at the same time, us as a company, we leverage machine learning for our own defenses. And so I think that you just have to be very wary of that dual use nature. And then again, getting to in many of these other areas that don't have the norms and the clarity, consistency, and principle that you're talking about, around AI and the ethics around it. And so the ethics around the use of AI is still really, really nascent. And so that's one of those areas, again, that needs to grow. We need some better definitional understanding of those things. And still also just understanding that even though it's machine learning, machine driven, human biases make their way into it. And we're seeing that an awful lot, both in areas as far as what data goes into it, the how you're structuring the parameters of models. So that's really a tough challenge. And I think corporations need to be aware of that. And then especially when you start thinking about leveraging some AI for behavioral like insider threat and how does that cross over into privacy issues. And so it's really, it's a tough challenge. But I do think that you can separate what aspects that you're focused on. I mean, that's fairly traditional to how corporations have worked with the government in the past as far as working on some aspects of defensive weaponry and machinery and so forth, and now it's just at a higher level. And it is a little bit more obscure and technical in some regards, but I think it's still something that we need to be focused on, especially again at the policy level and figuring that out. But I think corporations absolutely can look and help focus in both ways, and they need to. And going back to the hacking back, which we want to talk about that more, I agree 100% on that. I mean, it really is dangerous to start thinking about all the corporations starting to have an ability to go back against the PLA or even criminal groups. I mean, just the asymmetry and what could possibly go wrong, the range of what could go wrong is really quite disconcerting. And there's some legislation working through and helping to that wants to legalize hacking back, and so that's something to keep an eye on as well.
Interesting. Well, good. Well, we have about 20 or 25 minutes left. I'd love to turn it over to the audience for questions. I've got a lot more questions if the audience does have questions, but it looks like we have one right here in the front. Yes, sir.
Thank you for talking about this potpourri of issues. I see it all the time, and I talk a long time about asymmetry, how a Geneva Convention comes about, and how you can inflict sufficient pain that people will obey it. But I'm at, besides representing a lot of companies in this area, I'm active ISO, trying to work through issues of privacy and security and greater cooperation. And the greatest vulnerability that we see is not in terms of national security at the national level. It's weakness in the slit of state, local, and tribal activities, and vast vulnerabilities in regard to public utility authorities, to transportation, to hospitals, and the like of that. How are the larger companies like you, if you are, to the extent you're cooperating, look at Microsoft is selling a lot of products to these parties, how are you seeking to cooperate with those, with national security at the state and local level?
Great. Angela, David, when do you want to take that first, state and local national security imperatives?
Yeah, so first of all, thank you for bringing it up. It's something that I feel like oftentimes in Washington, D.C. gets overlooked. And we're actually seeing a lot of innovation occurring at the state and local level, not only in terms of adoption and digital transformation, but also in terms of the policy environment. Andrea had actually talked about that gap that exists sometimes the policy innovation is not occurring necessarily. What I'm actually seeing is policy innovation in the state level. And so one of the things is we engage, in the state and local process, again, in that same construct. These are our customers. They are also folks who are working at a more state or local level to protect national security and public safety. And so we have a variety of things that we do with them. One of the things I think that is most exciting, and maybe I'll mention two actually, one is the level of adoption of cloud services that is occurring in the state and local environment. This is something that the administration here had done with the last EO, talking about how to enable cloud services and shared services to be used. You know, there is sometimes I think an expectation that everyone's going to have the same capability to do security, and that's just not accurate. There are not enough people in the world to be doing security. And so there are places where we need to leverage and gain scale. And cloud is one of those great opportunities to be able to take individuals and scale impact of security over time.
CISA or CISA is sufficient antitrust protection against problems regarding the few dominant cloud providers?
Yeah, it's interesting, actually. I think our perspective on CISA is fairly similar to David's, which was it was an important and meaningful step forward. But we had not found ourselves severely hindered in information sharing previously. However, when we talked with many of our customers in either primarily regulated sectors, they were feeling a series of either concerns about antitrust or other concerns that may had hindered their sharing. And so for us, we felt like there was a bigger ecosystem value in moving CISA forward. Has that necessarily, I can't necessarily juxtapose the CISA conversation with the state and local one, but what I would say is we felt like it was important and meaningful, and not just here in the, again, we weren't hugely impacted by it, but it set forward a really good precedent. My job is global. I manage our global public policy work. And what I was encouraged by was following CISA. Yeah, did it have a huge impact for me here? Not really. But when I talked with folks in other places in the world, They were interested in CISA. They were interested in saying, how do I help and ensure that the companies in my country also feel like they can share information to manage risk? And in that way, I felt like it was really quite important.
Right. David, any thoughts on the gentleman's question?
Yeah, I mean, I want to echo Angela's observation about the adoption of cloud services at the state and local level, and just, you know, state and local governments availing themselves of the expertise at large tech companies, I think is an important development just in terms of data management and risk management. I should point out too that, you know, all Microsoft, Google, Facebook, other companies are focusing a lot of our efforts on election integrity now too, helping to secure the infrastructure that either runs campaigns or that election directors are using. So we have a service called Project Shield, free service that protects election sites from DDoS attacks, which can be devastating if they occur, you know, either on days of early voting or on the day of election. Your site goes down, and you can't find information about where you're supposed to vote or where you're, things of that nature. We've also too focused increasingly too on the fact that we are aware that campaigns, both high profile and low profile, are using our services just for basic productivity. So they're using Gmail to communicate. This is a problem that we've tried to rise to the occasion to address. We have a feature we unveiled last year called Advanced Protection. Some folks may be familiar with two-step verification or two-factor authentication. If you're not using it, I encourage whatever service you're using to take advantage of it. Provides another layer of protection on top of your username and password. But Advanced Protection was one of those very unique sort of situations where we weren't necessarily focusing on billions of users, but really on the 1% who are most at risk, whether it's activists, politicians, elected officials, journalists, people that are probably at higher risk of more sophisticated spear phishing attacks in particular, where certain types of two-step verification may be less safe than other types. So we encourage folks who are in that category of people being at the highest risk to use security-based two-step verification or two-factor authentication. So that's another area that we're working on, and that's a commitment I think we made too when we testified before the Senate Intelligence Committee last year on election integrity.
Terrific. Other questions? And by the way, we have microphones that are coming around, so if you could... Oh,
the mic is at this table.
Vince, you have the mic.
Sir, Andrew, I'd like to get granular on the second court. Because I understand the first accord reads as follows. Signatories will strive to protect all of our users and customers from cyber attacks, whether individual, organization, or government, irrespective of their technical acumen, culture, or location, or the motives of the attacker, whether criminal or geopolitical. Customers of the tech companies include ISIS. The U.S. government may wish to enter into an operation to degrade the capabilities of ISIS, cyber operation. What should the tech companies who are signatories to this, how should they think about such a request?
Yes, it's interesting, Vince, you asked that, because so first of all, you did get the wording of the first principle correct, and the first principle is about is an idea of neutrality, right? That regardless of your location, regardless of your technical acumen, if you are a user or a customer, you deserve to be protected. What I'd guess is the question on ISIS actually usually came up regarding the second principle, which is in fact why there is a small revision to the second principle almost immediately before we went out. And so the second principle talks about not engaging in offense. I don't have the words right up in front of me, but we added the word as a group, innocent. And so that was one of those things where we recognize that there are sometimes quote-unquote bad actors who are leveraging the capabilities of large service providers. And in that particular case, the reason we added the word innocent was to provide flexibility around the idea that there could be If there is a particular group of actors who, for example, by the UN has been declared a terrorist state, that then those we would not interfere with a government action got carried out against that actor. But it really came up more in the construct of that second pillar than it did in the first one, and that was the revision around making sure that we're protecting the innocent. And that gives us some flexibility in thinking about the application of that one.
So I have a follow-up. As a private company, how do you assess innocent versus not innocent? Is it sort of they have to be, you mentioned the UN, is it that they have to be sort of be globally understood to be a problem, and how do you assess that, right? Because in China might be freedom activists, in the US it might be terrorists. One person's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. So, what do we do with all that?
So first of all, the group is working on figuring that out because it is a commitment of 44 and probably more over time companies. But one of the things that we have talked about and the reason I provided that UN example is trying to not make subjective declarations ourselves and tying to something that has more broad or uniform agreement around it. That's why I actually hit the kind of UN terrorist group as an example.
Makes sense.
So you will not protect against non-innocent being attacked, but you will not assist in attacks on them.
Hold on, say that one more time.
as a read one and two, mm-hmm. you will not, if there's an attack on an innocent, you will not accept a non-innocent.
A bad person.
If it is, and again, we're scenario planning here, but yes, in the construct of the language of the tech accord, if there is a group that who is deemed deemed not innocent, then we may not actually take forward the steps to help ensure or protect their security. However, again, as a broad statement of commitment, we're in a 0.02% scenario that you just outlined. I think what is more important than the 0.02 scenario is really that broad commitment of a set of companies who are based in different places around the world coming together and saying, we have a statement of neutrality and our focus is on defense.
So you won't assist in an attack.
I think actually it's the point where we need to move on. I think I've clarified what the points and the roles are. And if you want to have a conversation about these edge cases of interpretation, I can represent Microsoft's views on this, but the Tech Accord is a commitment of a group of companies.
In the back.
Yes, I was wondering if you could discuss government's role in planning for tomorrow's threats as they invest in infrastructure moving forward and as they deal with the Internet of Things expanding. If you could just sort of discuss the threat landscape, how that is evolving, and basically how we could address that those threats in the best way moving forward.
So, Andrea, I know you've done some work on this.
Sure, yeah, it's a good question because that's sort of, you know, if we had the silver bullet to answer that all, that'd be great. But you know, so if you think about like IoT, like bots, we haven't even really talked about bots yet. And those are both for disinformation campaigns and for cyber attacks, both are leveraging bots for a broader reach and for very tactical impact. And so how it's evolving, if you think about Mirai from I think 2016, it was hundreds of thousands of machines. And again, going back to that's how we measure right now is the impact of the machines. We need to look beyond that a bit. That took down parts of the East Coast, took down some social media sites. That seemed like a really big deal. No one really talked as much about the BrickerBot from about 6 to 8 months ago, and that impacted in the millions, tens of millions of machines. And so even the technology that's being used by the attackers, it's escalating so quickly as far as the expanded reach of it, in large part because of some of this automation and the role of the bots, both social and for worms and propagation and so forth. And so there is some IoT legislation going forward. I actually don't know the current status of it. If someone else does, that would be great. But there is some good IoT legislation that Senator Warner has been pushing forward. And so that'd be great if that went through. And that's how a lot of the defensive aspects are really starting to be more focused on, they're becoming effects-based and looking at various impacts on the targets. And so you have the IoT legislation over there. There's something called the Deter Act, which is one that hasn't really gotten much media, and I think that's a really important one. And so DETER stands for, you know, it's an acronym for something. I can't, you know, defending elections, something, something, something. But it's why I like it is because it actually takes a nuanced perspective on the definition of protecting elections. So it incorporates both, you know, cyber attacks on machines and on hacking into websites and to campaigns. It also has a social media and disinformation component to it. So it lays out all the different ways that our elections could, that the integrity of the election might be attacked. And then it outlines, so if these things happen, you know, DNI will come in, we'll evaluate the, you know, that election. If it's deemed that there's some, you know, within 90 days, something like that, that an attack on the election occurred, then there's some several course of action. And the course of action also are laid out depending on who the attacker is how it's written. And so it's moving away from this sort of, you know, one-size-fits-all approach to these kind of attacks to looking at what's actually attacked, who's doing it, and then here's our broad range. It's not just a cyber tit-for-tat, which, again, for so long, that was a myopic vision that we had that, you know, if it's a cyber attack, we've got to respond to the cyber attack. And so we're really expanding that into the sanctions and persona non grata, indictments, all those kind of things. But again, you know, that hasn't moved forward to my knowledge either, but at least we're starting to see some, you know, glimmers of policy innovation starting to come through to address these various aspects of it. And I think we do need those. We need to really evolve those. You know, it's concerning that the issue that, you know, that there was legislation on hacking back really does worry me quite a bit. So, you know, on one hand, we absolutely need to modernize the CFAA since it was written, you know, in the time of, you know, when War Games came out, and the world's very different now.
Great movie.
Yep, great movie. Very good. But the world has evolved. And so we do need to evolve it and modernize it, but not in the way that, you know, legalizes hacking back for so many different reasons. One is it's unlikely to be effective, I mean, if for no other reason, but also there's plenty of reasons as far as risk escalation, conflict escalation, misattribution, like the list can go on and on and on. So those are some of the ways I think that the government can, but I think through legislation, and then, you know, that I'm sure there are other areas as far as, you know, incentivizing companies for better security. You've got NIST frameworks and it's helping provide some better insight on and better and switching the sort of the risk aversion to investing in these kind of security approaches. I think that's another way. You know, DHS has a good way. It has some different means for educating companies for what the risks are out there. So I think it's really a broad range of how the government can do it. And then even on with the workforce, right? There's an enormous workforce gap. The government can help in that area too. So I think the government can play a really large role in this, in working together with the companies.
Angela, David, thoughts on IoT? You don't have to. No?
I think Andrea covered the terrain pretty well there.
Yeah. So we have about 10 minutes left, so we'll take about one or two more questions. I saw there was one back here. No?
Actually, Dr. Lavaga just answered my question.
Great. Look at that. We're solving problems. Another couple of questions from the audience? If not, I will ask more questions. Oh, yes, right here in the front. Somebody have a mic? Here we go. Give us 1 second. We'll get you the mic.
Hi. I'm Heather Heimbach from Broadband Census. And so with the recent, you know, sort of scandals with Facebook over Huawei and, like, Cambridge Analytica, I just wanted to ask what are these other tech companies' views on working with international companies with data, and how do we protect, you know, U.S. data when you're also working with international companies?
Sure. So the House Small Business Committee just had a hearing yesterday on ZTE. We've seen the report from the House Intelligence Committee on Huawei and ZTE. A lot of times these companies tend to, we've heard about Kaspersky. So Russia and China, not surprising. We hear about their companies. The relationship between the governments there is a little different in industry. Angela, thoughts on how Microsoft deals with both supply chain, customers, governments? What's the story? What are you thinking here?
So first of all, I think everyone should know this in the room, but ultimately it is a global supply chain, and it's not going to be a global, it will not be a global supply chain. So, right, we have partnerships and agreements with both people who are suppliers to us and people who are either resellers or partner programs. It's a platform company. We love having those things. and so we have relationships with lots of different companies around the world. Couple of things to really think about, and this is, I think I've been doing public policy work on cybersecurity for probably 12 years now or so, maybe a little bit more than that. This is about the third time that supply chain security has come up in the public policy conversation. And I think it's a really good one to be having, right? There are different types of drivers that actually underpin the national security conversation on this, whether it is a national security series of concerns, some of the companies you just outlined here, the U.S. government has strong concerns about. If you look in other places in the world, there are economic drivers looking towards indigenous innovation or innovation itself being some of the concerns, and there are trade concerns. What we do is we really think in a very comprehensive way about looking at our supply chain practices across both development, deployment, and management of technology, and we have a broad series of programs. It's not just a particular program. Things that look at, for example, vetting vendors. We have supply chain security policies and requirements for vendors, and we put in terms of our contracts ways to do audit. So what I would guess I would highlight is, one, supply chain is a really valid concern. Two, it is not only an aperture of risk, it's also a way to use market forces to improve security over time. And collectively, both industry and government need to be thinking about what we bring to the table in terms of both capabilities and risk, and really understanding which part of the problem we're looking at. The national security concerns and the trade concerns may not necessarily be addressed with the same policy tool.
So how you buy and who you partner with can drive better security amongst those vendors and partners.
Yes.
Got it. Good. David, thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I would completely agree with what Angela just said. A couple of other things. I mean, we have relationships with dozens of OEMs, vis-a-vis, Android, which is open source. Any device manufacturers can license that technology. You know, one other thing I might add too is just one of the ways to reduce risk in the supply chain is to reduce complexity in the supply chain. We may not be unique among other cloud service providers, but we, in our data centers, we're custom. The servers that reside in those data centers that are storing Google account data are custom designed. They have a stripped down operating system.
You designed yourself.
Right. Right. So we're reducing the complexity, within our data centers, and as a result, reducing the attack vectors, reducing the vulnerabilities that could be exploited. And that has a cascading effect throughout our broader infrastructure and the ecosystem. So that's one, that's another way sort of when people are thinking about supply chain, they're not necessarily thinking about how we store data or how we design our infrastructure or how we think about securing account data, but that's one way that we tackle that problem too. Right.
Well, so Andrew, we have 2 minutes left, and since you have the highest level degree on the panel, having a doctorate, you get the last word.
Oh, geez. Yes, one area, just to piggyback on that, it takes a little bit of a different angle. It's the data localization also going on that is going to impact what companies have, what kind of data they have, and what kind of access they have to provide to different countries depending on where they are. And so I think that's, it's not directly supply chain, but this gets back to the global network aspect of it. And there's more and more countries that are, requiring all data for their systems be held on servers within those sovereign boundaries. And so we're moving more towards the splinter net versus the global internet, and that's going to impact a lot on how companies are doing business abroad and what their strategies are for protecting that kind of data. And that's really the way I look at it. That's sort of the battle for the internet that's going on right now. You got the GDPR going on right now with the data protection on individual privacy and so forth. Then you've got these other movement towards the cyber sovereignty that's looking more at government access to data. And that those are directly in conflict, which also gets back to why these norms are so important. Because if our tech companies and our government that's in favor of democracy is not pushing forth these norms, other countries and other groups with other orthogonal interests to democracy are going to push forth their norms for the future of the internet. And so that's the big battle I see underway right now.
Terrific. Well, join me in thanking our panel.